think he's pretending.
Come again?
Russ, he's just talking about outer space to keep people at arm's length.
I know.
He doesn't want to play basketball.
If he didn't want to play, I don't think he would have put on such a show tonight, Coach says.
I have a bad feeling about this, Coach.
We do the best we can, Finley. We can't change what happened to the boy's parents, but we can give him an opportunity to do what he's best at. He needs to play basketball, just like you do. Trust me.
Coach has to believe he's doing the right thing, because he doesn't know what else to do.
I once heard someone say that everything looks like a nail to the man with a hammer in his hand. I thought it was just a corny cliche when I first heard that expression, but I think it actually applies to Coach right about now, which makes me sort of sad.
I want to play basketball and win the state championship. I want to be the starting point guard. I also feel like I should be helping Boy 21, and I'm not sure Coach is right about Russ needing to play b-ball. But I'm not the coach, and so I say, I'll shoot the ball when I'm told to shoot the ball from now on.
Good, he says. See you tomorrow at practice. Chapter 27. Dad left just as soon as the game ended. He had to get to work on time. Because I want to be alone, I tell Pop that I'm going out for hot wings with the team. Aaron's parents take the old man home, and I walk through the gray, dirty, trash-everywhere streets of Belmont. Almost all the streetlights have been smashed with rocks, so it's dark. It's frigid out, and I'm still in my shorts, with a winter coat on top. As I walk, I'm surprised that I'm not thinking about the game or losing my starting position. I'm thinking about Boy 21 and how bad he must be hurting. People just don't go around saying they're from outer space for nothing. The deep bass of an expensive car stereo system approaches from behind. I turn my head, but all I see are two bright headlights. Somehow, I know the car's going to stop, and it does just as it reaches me. The music turns off, and I hear, "Yo, White Rabbit, get in!" It's Terrell's voice. I walk to the passenger side window. He's riding with his brother Mike. Both of them are wearing gold chains and huge diamond earrings.
"Don't just stand there looking at us," Mike yells from the driver's seat. "Get your lily ass in the car before you freeze it off in those ball trunks. Your knees look like snowballs."
I open the back door and hop in, but Mike doesn't drive.
"You knew about this outer space shit from the beginning, didn't you?" Terrell asks.
I don't see the point of lying, so I nod. Terrell has turned his body so that he's facing me, but Mike's looking at me through dark sunglasses in the rearview mirror. It's after 10 and he's wearing sunglasses. I smell some sort of sweet smoke in the air and then see that Mike is puffing on a joint. I want to get out of the car, but I know I can't.
"How crazy is he?" Terrell says.
"I don't know."
"Crazy like he might come to school with a gun and start shooting people, or crazy like he just says amusing things about outer space?" Terrell says.
The latter, I think," I say.
"What you mean, the latter?" Mike says. "You gonna climb a damn tree or something?"
"So he's just all talk," Terrell says.
"I don't really know."
"Coach asked you to help him, right?" Mike says.
"Yep."
"So, you go and be his friend even though he gonna end up taking your position?" Mike says.
"Right. That's White Rabbit for you," Terrell says.
"You good people," Mike says.
And then he takes a drag off his joint.
"I like you, White Rabbit. You got what the old people call character."
"Russ is crazy as a mofo, but he makes us a better team," Terrell says.
"I'ma drive you home," Mike says. "You all right?"
I don't want to let Mike drive me home because he's high, but there's nothing I can do about it. So I just sit quietly in the back seat. When one of the most feared drug dealers in the neighborhood wants to drive you home, you let him drive you home. I know he's strapped. There are probably several guns in the car, and who knows what's in the trunk. We pull up to my house, and just before I get out, Mike says,
"You need any paper, White Rabbit?"
"Money," Terrell says when I don't answer. I shake my head no.
"Let us know if your family ever needs paper," Mike says. "You can always work for us. We like to employ people with character."
I nod once, even though I never want to be a drug runner, and then get out as fast as I can. When Mike and Terrell drive away, I go inside and find my grandfather drinking a beer. My dad's already at work, so it'll just be Pop and me tonight.
"You feel like shit, don't you?"
Pop says.
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't. Your father's always telling you that you can outwork talent, but I got a newsflash for you, Finley. You could work as hard as you humanly can for the rest of your life, and you'll never be as good as what we saw tonight.
He takes a swill from his bottle and says,
I fancy a bath. You game?
I nod and push Pop into the bathroom, where I strip the old man and lift him into the tub. As I hold the detachable showerhead for Pop, he washes his hair, and I watch the suds run down his neck and over Grandmom's green rosary beads. Pop won't even take them off to bathe. When he finishes, he tells me to turn off the water, and when I do, he says,
Coach will work you into the games. Don't worry. It'll work out.
I'm wondering what Boy 21 is thinking right now. Did he enjoy playing tonight? Did it make him feel better? Does basketball help him the way it helps me? And if so, does he need the starting position more than I do?
I love watching you play ball, Finley. Best part of my days lately. Makes me feel like I still have legs, even. But life's more than games. This Russ, he's special. Anyone could see that. And it's hard to be special, Finley. You understand what I'm saying?
I don't understand what Pop is saying, but I nod anyway.
You're special too, Finley. You don't always get to pick the role you're going to play in life, but it's good to play whatever role you got the best way you can, Pop says. And I know I'm a damn hypocrite for saying that tonight, but that don't make what I said a lie. We've both had hard lives so far. No favors done for either of us.
I can't think of anything to say, especially since I'm not special at all. So I just get Pop out of the tub and into bed. I lie awake all night thinking about what has happened and what it all means.
Chapter 28.
The next day, just as soon as his grandfather drives out of sight, Boy 21 reaches into his over-the-shoulder bag and pulls out a brown robe made from bath towels safety pinned together. He slips his head and arms through the holes. On his chest, he has spelled the word space with red fabric that looks like it was once a t-shirt. He then ties a sparkly gold cape around his neck. The cape looks store-bought and expensive, as it has a silver clasp and the material is much heavier than what might be used to make a cheap Halloween costume. I just stare at Boy 21 when he puts on a motorcycle helmet that he has spray-painted silver. He's glued a golden eagle to the top of the helmet, the kind of eagle you might see at the end of a flag post in a classroom. I wonder why he hid the robe and cape when his grandfather must have seen the helmet. But I don't ask, of course.
No more Russ Washington, he says. It's Boy 21 everywhere I go now. The time to leave Earth is soon. No point in lying about everything now. They've all seen my extraterrestrial powers anyway.
I give him a look that says, you sure about this? Boy 21 ignores my look and says,
And after practice, I'd like you to listen to a special CD that will explain everything. I'm going to ask Wes to join us as well. Will you listen to the recruiting CD with me?
I nod. What type of CD could explain everything? I want to know, but I also realize that Boy 21 is losing it. Or is he?
Students mob us as we approach the high school. They want to know why Boy 21's wearing what he's wearing, where exactly in outer space he came from, and how many points he'll score in the next game.
The best-looking girls blink a lot and say, Hey, Boy 21. Blow him kisses, and even reach up to touch his silver helmet in a sexy way. It's almost unbelievable, especially if you don't know how popular basketball is in Belmont. More and more people crowd around us, but Boy 21 just keeps moving forward with this very eerie smile on his face. Who knew that acting like a total freak would make you popular? Or is it just because he's an extraordinary basketball player? As everyone continues to press in around us and yell questions, I start to feel invisible because no one says a word to me, even though they obviously know Boy 21 and I are tight. No one ever said much to me before, but now that Boy 21 has appeared, it makes me realize that maybe he has something I don't. Not only athletic ability, but also star power. No pun intended. When we finally arrive at the high school steps, he stops and says,
I will score many, many points in the next game. Definitely more than 40, guaranteed. And I come from a place that you don't even know exists.
I will be returning to that outer space place shortly, and anything else you might learn about me will come through my Belmont Earthling tour guide, Finley, who will also serve as my earthly documentarian. Most of the students surrounding us laugh, as if Boy 21 is joking, but I can see Aaron 20 people deep in the crowd, and she's biting down on her lip.
Finley? Boy 21 says. Please tell the masses all they need to know about Boy 21.
Everyone turns and looks at me, but of course I don't speak, because I'm a minimal speaker, yes, but what would I say even if I were a blabbermouth?
No fair! White Rabbit never says anything! How do you run basketball like that? We want to know what you're playing at. What's up with the spaceman outfit? You in the Black Eyed Peas now? Who are you?
I'm Boy 21 from the cosmos, Russ says.
And then he turns so quickly that his sparkly gold cape flies up into the air. I march after him into the building. The questions continue all day. Boy 21 just smiles and smiles and repeats the same standard lines about coming from the cosmos to learn about emotions. The less he says to our classmates, the more popular he seems to become. Everyone wants to know his secret, and that's his power, just having one. The local papers don't run any information about Boy 21, except the number of points he scored in the game, and his assists and rebounds. The editors were probably too scared to report what Russ actually told them, but I wonder how long it'll be before his real story comes out, and he'll have to face the truth about his past. Our teachers don't ask Russ about his costume, which leads me to believe that they were instructed not to, because he looks absolutely ridiculous. Like an insane person dressed up for Halloween, or the Mummers Parade, or something even crazier. I worry about lunch, when we'll see the rest of the team without the close supervision of teachers. But we're called down to guidance and separated just before it's time to eat. Boy 21 is instructed to head into Mrs. Joyce's office, and I'm directed to Mr. Gore's. Mr. Gore's jerry curl is extra shiny today.
I had lunch sent up, he says when I sit down in front of his desk. Go ahead and eat.
I look at the hot turkey sandwich, white bread, tan yellow gravy. It looks good. I'm hungry, so I eat.
Have you figured out yet why Coach picked you to help Russ?
Mr. Gore says. I shake my head no. Mr. Gore smiles broadly. Too broadly, as if every single one of his teeth is calling me a liar. He touches his fingertips together and keeps tapping the tops of his palms so it looks like a spider is doing push-ups on a mirror. Tell me something, Finley. Mr. Gore looks deeply into my eyes until I look down at my food. How did your grandfather lose his legs? I hate it when Mr. Gore asks me irrelevant questions, especially this one in particular. I feel my face burn like it always does whenever I'm in his office. I hate this feeling I get when I'm forced to listen to his pointless, stupid questions. Don't you think it kind of odd you're not knowing the answer to that one? Have you never thought to ask him how he lost his legs? All these years, it's never crossed your mind to ask? My hands are balled into tight fists. He's trying to make me upset, so I'll talk, and I don't like it. What happened to your mother? Mr. Gore asks. I'm starting to get really annoyed with this line of questioning, especially since Guidance has a student who says he's from outer space in the next room. What is the point of these questions? I'm sweating now. Don't lose it, I tell myself. Do something productive to take your mind off of what's happening. I work on consuming my hot turkey sandwich. I take huge bites and enjoy the feeling of swallowing. My stomach begins to feel full. I savor the taste of meat and gravy and doughy bread.
Finley,
Mr. Gore says,
are you listening to me?
I nod without making eye contact.
So, what do you think we should do about Russ? He asks.
I don't know.
How should I know? How are you doing?
He asks.
Fine.
Are you upset about losing your starting position?
I shrug.
It's okay to be upset.
I quickly eat the mashed potatoes and drink the milk.
I want out of here. Do you want to know how Mr. and Mrs. Allen were murdered?
Mr. Gore asks me, which surprises me. No.
I don't want to know that. Why the hell would I want to know that?
Can I leave?
I ask.
It's okay to feel upset, Finley. This is a lot for you to process.
It's more than most young people could deal with.
I just want you to know that I'm here to listen.
Should you ever feel like talking about Russell or yourself, I'm a resource for you. A safe ear.
Thanks, I say, but I'm already walking toward the door. When I exit, Mr. Gore all but yells,
"It might help Russell if you told him about your mother."
I don't want to think about what he's implying, so I just leave Mr. Gore's office and take a seat in the hallway outside the guidance department offices. I clench my fists and then stretch out my fingers as wide as they will go. I repeat that process over and over again until I calm down a little. Boy 21 comes out a few minutes later, but he doesn't say anything to me. He looks unfazed. He's still wearing his brown robe, gold cape, and silver helmet. I follow him down the hallway to our lockers. The hall monitor hassles us, but Boy 21 remembered to get a pass, so we're okay. We trade in our morning books for our afternoon books, and then Boy 21 says,
"They don't want me to wear my outer space clothes. They say it disrupts the school day. Do you agree?"
"No," I say, which surprises me. That makes Boy 21 smile. I didn't like my conversation with Mr. Gore, and that makes me apt to disagree with anything guidance has to say.
"Maybe I could get my parents to beam down another outer space cape for you, Finley," Boy 21 says. "Would you like that?"
"Very much so," I say, and then smile. We finish our day, and then we attend practice. Boy 21 takes off his space clothes and puts on a practice uniform so that he looks simply terrestrial instead of extraterrestrial. When no one on the team brings up outer space or anything Russ said last night, I figure Coach must have talked to all the other team members and instructed them to stay mum. Boy 21 invites Wes to listen to the CD with us after practice, saying it's a little like NERD because it's related to outer space, and Wes agrees, although he quickly changes the subject by saying, "I need to work on my free throws." So we shoot some free throws until Coach shows up and runs us through a regular practice. I run with the second team, and that relegation stings a little, although I try to rise to the challenge of playing against our best players. I'm able to lose myself in sweat, aching muscles, and the repetition of the drills.
"Looking good today, Finley,"
Coach says more than once, which makes me feel a little better. After we grab our gear in the locker room, Boy 21, Wes, and I hop into Mr. Allen's Cadillac.
"You want me to drop you boys off at home?" Mr. Allen says.
"They're coming over to listen to an important CD, Boy 21 says.
"They are?"
Mr. Allen looks at us in the rearview mirror. Brown eyes, gray eyebrows.
"What CD?"
"It's something for school," Boy 21 lies. "Mostly about science."
"Okay then,"
Mr. Allen says. When we arrive at the Allen's home, Mrs. Allen insists that we each shower up, put on our school clothes, and sit down to dinner.
"I didn't know you were coming, but we'll make do," she says, which is nice.
So we all grab quick showers and then eat a chicken salad dinner. Wes is very polite and carries the conversation as the Allens ask us about basketball in school.
"We're reading Le Petit Prince in French class," Wes says. "You might like that one, Russ, come to think of it, because it's about a boy from another planet."
Russ says,
"I'd like to read that."
Mrs. Allen gives Wes a hard look. I guess she doesn't want us to encourage the space fixation. And Mr. Allen says,
"Basketball is going well?"
"Fine," Wes says. "We have a good team this year. Coach thinks we could go deep into the postseason."
"That's so,"
Mr. Allen says.
"Any new defenses? A press, perhaps?"
Wes tells Mr. Allen all about our playbook, both what we have already used in games and what we haven't. They talk hoops for a long time while the rest of us listen. With Wes around, I feel like I can be myself and remain quiet. The Allens never ask me a direct question, and Wes is very talkative by nature, so it's an easy dinner. A few times, I catch Mr. and Mrs. Allen staring at Russ's space robe and cape. There's a sadness in their eyes. Boy 21 doesn't wear the helmet to dinner.
"We will go to my room now," Boy 21 says when we finish dinner, "and listen to that CD for school."
"Okay," Mrs. Allen says. "Study hard."
"Excellent meal, ma'am," Wes says. I nod in agreement. And then we follow Boy 21 up into his room, where the walls and ceiling are now entirely covered with glow-in-the-dark stars, which seem to pulse energy. It's a little bit eerie and disorienting, but also kind of beautiful in an odd way.
"Sit on the bed,"
Boy 21 says when he closes his bedroom door. We sit. And then Russ begins to pace.
"So," Wes says, "let's hear this CD."
"Can you guys keep a secret?"
Boy 21 asks.
Sure, Wes says.
You know it, I say.
I used to do this thing with my dad, Boy 21 says.
He's still pacing.
And I've never told anyone about it before.
What thing? Wes says. And then he glances at me nervously, which makes me wonder if Wes somehow found out that Russ's parents were murdered.
Back home in California, he used to drive me out to where there are no houses or lights so that we could see lots of stars. We used to drive to this place on the coast, a little cliff that overlooked the Pacific Ocean. We'd park and walk along the edge until we couldn't see the road anymore, so that car lights wouldn't break the mood. Boy 21's pacing slows a little. We'd throw down a blanket to lie on and put the CD player between our heads, and while we stargazed, Dad would play this music. He holds up the CD. The cover features a black man wearing a crazy, pharaoh-looking outer space outfit and a long cape. Behind him are stars and what looks like Saturn, maybe a planet with a ring around it. It's called Space is the Place, and it's the soundtrack to a movie that my father says is pretty bad, although I've never seen it. It's by the jazz musician Sun Ra and his Intergalactic Solar Orchestra. Sun Ra claimed that his music could transport people to outer space. I was hoping that maybe we could pretend we were looking up at the stars and listen to the CD together. See what happens. Just like Dad and I used to do.
Wes looks at me sort of funny, and I shrug to let him know that I'm game. Why not? Especially since it might help explain why Russ needs to be Boy 21. Plus, I'm really curious to find out what such music might sound like.
Okay, Wes says, but he sounds hesitant.
Boy 21 smiles and stops pacing.
You're gonna love this. Space is the place. Okay, lie down on the floor. Get comfortable. Look up at the stars. And don't talk until the entire CD is finished playing. That's the one rule. You'll know when the experience is over because I'll turn on the light.
Wes gives me another doubtful glance, but I'm already lying on the floor, so he follows my example. Boy 21 pulls the blinds and turns off the lights so that his stars glow a weird green, and then he presses play on his CD player and lies down between us. The CD opens with strange outer space noises and a woman chanting, "It's after the end of the world. Don't you know that yet?" Then there are very strange pulsing noises and squealing echoes that sound like a trumpet being tortured to death. But as I look up at the green constellations, I get the feeling that I'm really in outer space, which is weird because how would I even know what that feels like? The rest of the CD features long African drumming sessions, what sounds like a piano crashing down flights of stairs, Sun Ra preaching about the altered destiny and the living myth and powering his spaceship with music, all over strange noises that sound more like a computer malfunctioning than jazz. A woman sings nicely for a time about a great tomorrow and is encouraging us to sign up with Outer Space Ways Incorporated if we find Earth boring. Then there is a song about Pharaoh being on the throne when the black man ruled the land. And I wonder what that has to do with outer space. But I sort of realize that the whole record is about black culture and how it might thrive more easily in the cosmos. The music sounds nothing like NERD. At all. But it's very interesting. And as I lie there listening, gazing up at Boy 21's fantasy outer space, I feel as though I'm in a trance or something. And I actually do imagine myself traveling through distant galaxies, which is pretty cool. I've never taken drugs, but I wonder if taking acid might feel something like listening to Space is the Place in the dark while staring up at glow-in-the-dark sticker constellations. The last song is the title track, and it's upbeat and makes me feel like I really want to go to outer space where there's no limit to the things that you can do. After listening to the CD, it's easy to see where Boy 21 is coming up with his weird philosophies and costumes. Wes and I don't make a sound through the entire experience. And when it's over, Boy 21 turns on the lights. Wes and I sit up and blink.
"Now that was different," Wes says while making a lemon face as if he's really saying, "What the hell was that?"
Boy 21 says,
"So, what do you think?"
"About what?" Wes says.
"Outer space. Do you want to come with me?"
Wes raises his eyebrows. "Where exactly do you think you're going?"
"Saturn, and then beyond,"
Boy 21 says.
Black man in the cosmos. That's where my parents are now.
Finley too, or a space only for black people, Wes says.
I note the sarcasm in Wes's voice.
Finley has a calming presence, Boy 21 says.
We'll make an exception. He'll be our token white space traveler.
I smile. All of this is insane. Russ could be kidding, pretending, messing with us. But Wes is uncomfortable.
Okay, Wes says. We'll go to outer space with you.
When are we leaving?
Sooner than you think, Boy 21 says.
Right, Wes says.
Got it.
Now, Finley and I have to go, homework and all. We'll see you tomorrow morning?
Very well, Boy 21 says. I'm so glad that you'll be making the journey with me.
We can listen to Sun Ra some more to get used to being in outer space. We'll practice being in the cosmos again soon.
I want to talk to Russ about the music and why he and his father used to listen to it on the cliff, under the stars. But Wes has already exited the room, and he's my ride home. So I'll just ask Russ tomorrow, when we're alone. It's easier to talk when it's just Russ and me anyway. Downstairs, we say goodbye to Mr. and Mrs. Allen.
Do you want to ride home?
Mr. Allen asks.
I live just around the corner, Wes says. My pop will drive Finley home.
A block away from the Allen's home, Wes says,
I think this is serious. That music was nuts. I can't believe I lay there for all that time listening.
He's either psycho or messing with us.
I'm surprised Wes didn't think it was an interesting experience. Or he's just doing what he has to do to get through the day, I say.
What do you mean?
I don't get to answer because I hear someone screaming my name. I turn around and see that Boy 21 is sprinting toward us, his cape trailing.
Finley! Finley, wait up!
Wes and I look at each other. He's just as concerned as I am. When Boy 21 reaches us, he puts his arm on my shoulder and pants for a few seconds.
What's going on? Wes says.
My grandfather's coming to pick us up.
I see the headlights of Mr. Allen's Cadillac coming toward us now.
I told you, Wes said, we don't need a ride.
Coach just called, says Russ, still panting. There's been an accident.
What happened? Wes says. Just say it.
Russ ignores Wes, puts his other hand on my shoulder, and looks into my eyes. I see the Russ I saw on his birthday when he was talking about his father on my roof. The real Russ, not Boy 21.
It's Erin, Russ says. She's in the hospital. She was hit by a car.
What? Wes says. How?
Don't know, Russ says.
Someone's jabbing a finger in my throat again. I can't breathe. Mr. Allen pulls up, rolls down the window, and says,
Come on, get in.
I'm sliding through the worst streets of Belmont now, seeing my blank reflection in the window, my face superimposed on our shitty neighborhood.
Breathe. Try to breathe, I tell myself, but it's getting harder and harder.
What happened? I finally get the words out.
Is she okay?
But no one answers, not even Mr. Allen, which seems bad. Really bad. Erin. If you have the words, there's always a chance that you'll find the way. Seamus Heaney. Chapter 29. Mr. Allen drops Russ, Wes, and me off at the emergency room and then goes to park his car. The automatic sliding doors close behind us and I throw up in the waiting room trash can. It feels like I'm turning inside out. When I come up for air, half the room is looking at me. There's maybe 20 or so sick, weary people sitting in chairs, one homeless man pacing at the far end of the room yelling, Whenever I get help, I'm gonna be thankful! Whenever I get help, I'm gonna be thankful! The other half is watching a show about sharks on the TV that hangs in the corner. I glance up just in time to see the massive jaws of a great white clamp down on a sea lion. Russ puts his hand on my back and says,
You all right?
I puke again, and just look up at my teammates when I finish.
I don't know how I am.
Listen, Wes says. You're gonna have to lie and say you're family or they won't let you in. I know, because when my sister had her baby, her friends tried to come in during the birth, and the hospital people said only immediate family could visit. So tell them you're Rod. They're probably not gonna let Russ and me in, so you have to get yourself together. Wes's hand is on my back now, too. He says,
You need to be strong for Erin.
Be a man, okay?
I nod because I'm supposed to, but I feel like I'm gonna throw up again. At the main information desk, Wes tells the woman that I'm Aaron's brother, and, just like he predicted, he and Russ are made to stay in the waiting room. Well, I'm led to what the check-in person calls the trauma center. I stand in the doorway for a few seconds before I enter Aaron's room. It's like a nightmare. Her left leg is in a soft cast, and there's a plastic neck brace holding her chin in a very rigid position. Her right arm's all wrapped up. There are red bandages on her face that were once white. The skin around her eyes is purple and black. Her face is really puffy and shiny. It looks like someone smeared Vaseline under her eyes. Mrs. Quinn's sitting next to the bed, which has wheels on it, so maybe it's not a bed. I don't know. They're holding hands. Erin's moaning and her cheeks are wet with tears. I'll leave you alone with your family, the nurse says. I stand frozen for a long time, just watching, wondering if this can be real. Erin looks ruined. Mrs. Quinn's hair is all frizzy and wild and her eyes look small and scared. She's staring at the window even though the blinds have been pulled. Neither Erin nor her mother notices me at first. I walk around to the far side of the bed and take Erin's other hand in mine. She doesn't squeeze. When we make eye contact, it doesn't even look like her because of the swelling. But I recognize the shamrock green eyes. She starts talking really quickly.
Philly, my leg's shattered. I'm never going to play basketball again, ever. It's over. That's it. My season's ruined. My basketball career's over. No chance for a college scholarship now. When they hit me, they knew it. They saw my face. I flew up onto the hood of their car. I was thrown onto the street, and they just left me there like I was a dead animal. It seemed like they even sped up, went, "But that can't be true, right? Who would do something like that? And now I can't play basketball. What am I going to do about college? How are we going to get out of Belmont now? I should have made my decision and committed earlier. How could they leave me there? I don't want you to see me like this, Finley. I must look so ugly. Maybe you should leave. No, don't leave. And the paramedics cut through my brand new sports bra, too. I just got it 2 days ago, and that bra cost a lot of money, and..."
"Shh," Mrs. Quinn says. "You're in shock, honey. You'll be playing basketball in no time. We'll get you a new sports bra. It's going to be okay."
So many thoughts are running through my head, but I can't seem to make sense of any of them.
"It hurts, Finley. It hurts so much. I can't move my leg."
When Erin starts to sob, she looks like a little kid who's been tortured to the point of exhaustion. I can see the pain tunneling its way through her face and body. It hurts for her to even cry. I want to tell her it'll be okay, that she'll be playing ball again soon. I want to ask her how she got hit, what happened. Will she ever be able to walk again, let alone play basketball? I look to Erin's mom for help. She can't have painkillers until they rule out any possible head injuries. They're going to scan her brain soon, and then, once they rule out brain damage, they'll give her drugs, Mrs. Quinn says. "You just have to hold on a little longer, Erin."
"What about her leg?" I ask. "What did the doctor say about that?"
When Mrs. Quinn doesn't answer my question, I study her face. She looks very scared herself. Suddenly, I understand that it's probably worse than I initially thought.
"Finley?"
Erin says. Her eyes are red, but the green shines even now, even amid all the swelling and bruising. Maybe even more so.
"Will you please be my boyfriend again?" she says. "I need you to be my boyfriend now. I'm scared. I'm really scared. Please be my boyfriend again. I can't go through this alone. Please. Please."
I nod. "Of course I will."
"I need you to say it," she says.
And her voice sounds tiny and childlike and so unlike Erin that I really start to worry. "I'm your boyfriend again now," I say.
"Then talk to me. Tell me something else," she says.
"Like what?"
"Anything to take my mind off the pain."
"I just threw up before I came in here."
"Really? Are you okay?"
Wes and Russ are in the lobby. Boy 21 made us lie on his bedroom floor in the dark and listen to this jazz CD about using music to travel through outer space. And then I was confused, and suddenly I'm at the hospital, and I was so worried about you that I just threw up. I puked twice. I puked yellow bile even.
Very romantic.
You really know how to make a girl feel special, Finley, she says. Which makes me feel good because she smiles for a second.
I've missed you.
Look what I have to do to get your attention.
She tries to laugh, but the attempt hurts her and she starts crying again. I'm afraid that Erin might die because she looks that bad. It's going to be okay.
No, it's not. It's really not going to be okay, Finley.
Erin tries to laugh, but only starts to cry harder. Her mom strokes her forehead and says,
shh, it is okay. Everything's fine.
Because I don't know what else to do, I start to pet Erin's hand like it's a cat or something. After a minute or so, she yells,
just everyone stop touching me, okay?
Mrs. Quinn flinches. I try to make eye contact with Erin, but she's staring fiercely at the ceiling. I can tell that she doesn't want to look at me all of a sudden, and that I should just be quiet. We wait around silently for a long time until they take Erin into a room where they will scan her brain. Mrs. Quinn's allowed to accompany her, but a nurse tells me to stay behind. Being alone in a hospital freaks me out, so I return to the ER waiting room to see if Wes and Russ are still there. I find them with Mr. Allen, watching a show about snakes. On the hanging TV, a snake with a head as big as a football is in the process of swallowing what looks like a dog, although I can only see the hind leg sticking out of the snake's mouth. I wonder why they play these types of shows in the ER waiting room, where people are already feeling depressed about hurt loved ones. Wouldn't they find more lighthearted programming? Mr. Allen, Wes, and Russ stand when they see me. Russ is no longer wearing his cape.
How's Erin?
Mr. Allen says. I shake my head and say, not good.
What's wrong with her? Russ says.
Her leg's shattered and she has bruises all over her face. They're scanning her brain for damage now. She was rambling for a time and then she got really angry and started yelling at me like I did something wrong when all I was doing was holding her hand.
The girl's in shock, Mr. Allen says. Won't last. She'll be back to normal soon.
Sorry to hear that, Wes says. Damn. Boy 21 says nothing. I look up and the snake has finished swallowing. Its midsection is now the shape and size of the dog. It almost looks fake. I'm gonna stay here, I say. You guys can leave. Thanks for waiting.
You sure? Wes says.
Yeah, I can catch a ride home with the Quinns if I need to.
Tell Erin we're pulling for her, Russ says.
Yeah, Wes says. Please do.
We'll pray for her tonight,
Mr. Allen says.
Thanks.
I go back to the trauma center, but Erin and her mom are still in the brain scanner room. Alone in the hospital, I think about how fragile people are. How anyone can disappear in a second and be gone forever. How close I've come to losing Erin. And I start to remember things I don't want to remember. So I bite down on the triangle of skin between my left thumb and forefinger until it hurts enough to stop my brain from dredging up any of the garbage that sits at the bottom of my memory. When Erin's wheeled back into the room, she has an IV drip in her arm and is semi-conscious. Her brain's okay, Mrs. Quinn says. She's on morphine now. I pull up a chair and hold Erin's hand. I'm your boyfriend again, I tell her.
That's good,
she says, and then smiles once before she closes her eyes. Chapter 30. Eventually, Coach shows up with the girls' coach, Mrs. Battle, a large, squat, serious lady who always wears a tracksuit. Tonight, she has on a navy blue number with three silver stripes running the length of her arms and legs. Erin's mother and father repeat all the information we know. Hit and run, shattered leg, major reconstructive surgery. After the Quinns explain the metal external fixator, a superskeleton on the outside of Erin's leg that'll hold all the bones in place, there's silence. What else is there to say, really? Erin's season is over. Coach shakes his head sadly. Mrs. Battle frowns and says, tell Erin the team will visit. As if that'll really help. Everyone nods sort of dumbly, and then Coach says, Finley, I'll drive you home. Let's give the Quinns some time to themselves. Erin's drugged and out for the night. There's nothing for you to do here. I look at the Quinns and see that the wrinkles around their eyes are pink and raw. It does look like they want to be alone, so I nod and follow Coach out of the hospital. We say goodbye to Mrs. Battle in the parking lot and then get into Coach's truck.
The Belmont Street silently pass by the passenger window. I see a man sleeping on the sidewalk. A small abandoned bonfire and an oil drum makes an alley glow. Hookers in wigs, short skirts, and fur coats are pacing under the overpass. I have to take care of my pop, I say, just to break the silence. I have to put him to bed. I'm taking you home, Coach says, but that's it. He doesn't say anything else, which makes me feel sort of strange. It's late, so Dad's already left for work. Coach tells Pop about the hit and run, how Aaron was walking home from practice and a car came around the corner just as Aaron was crossing the street, hit her, and then sped away. Pop just shakes his head, grabs onto the crucifix at the end of Grandmom's rosary beads, and says, I hate this neighborhood. I get the old man's diaper changed, carry him upstairs, and then put him to bed. When I turn out the lights, Pop says, What did Aaron tell you about the accident? Anything that Coach left out? Just what we told you. Nothing else? You sure? I think about it, replaying Aaron's words in my mind. She said they might have sped up before they hit her.
That's what I thought.
The old man shakes his head and blows air through his broken, jagged teeth. What? Maybe this wasn't an accident. What are you saying, Pop?
You're not stupid, Finley. Stop pretending you don't understand what's going on.
I think about what the old man means and immediately dismiss his words as crazy. Why would anyone want to break Aaron's leg? Back in the living room, Coach has helped himself to one of Pop's beers and is sitting on the couch. Wanted to speak with you, he says. Before I can think better of it, I say, Do you think that maybe someone hit Aaron intentionally to get back at Rod? Coach opens his eyes really wide. He looks at me for a moment, and then he says,
Don't know, and I don't want to know either. You don't want to know that, Finley. Haven't you lived in this neighborhood for 18 years? Don't go there. Useless information. Not a damn thing to do with thoughts like that. You hear me?
He takes a sip of Pop's beer and says,
Sit.
I sit.
I'm real sorry about what happened to Aaron. It's a shame. A damn shame.
Coach looks down at his hands for a few moments, but when he looks up, he's smiling, which makes me feel very weird.
In other news, the cat's out of the bag. You don't have to keep Russ's secret anymore.
In other news?
Did Coach really just make that transition? I'm already getting calls from top programs. Coach K phoned just this morning. Coach K himself. Duke basketball. Russ really has a shot to go far. And your helping him get through this tough period is commendable. I want you to know that I appreciate it very much, and that you'll be getting your minutes, don't you worry. I know this is a tough night for you, Finley, and that's why I wanted to say I'm proud of you. You did a good thing helping Russ, but the job's not done yet.
I just stare at Coach. I know that he's trying to make me feel better about losing my starting position, that he's thanking me, but with Aaron in the hospital, with my having just seen how bad she was hurt and understanding that her hopes for college scholarship are now over, this hardly seems like the appropriate time to be discussing Russ. My hands are balled and I could feel my face getting hot.
I just wanted to take that off your mind, in light of all you have to think about now, with Aaron in the hospital, Coach says. I'm not displeased with you, quite the opposite, and the doctors will fix Aaron's leg. Don't worry about the rest. You can't control the rest, so just forget about those questions you were asking earlier, okay?
I nod because I don't want to continue this conversation. Coach sips his beer once more before he places it on the coffee table and says goodbye. Then I'm alone. I stretch out on the couch and wait for my father to come home so that he can advise me, but I fall asleep somewhere around 3. I sit up when I hear the front door open. I blink.
Finley? Dad says.
Why are you sleeping on the couch? My face must look terrible, because Dad sits next to me and says, What's wrong? After a minute or so of waking up and thinking and remembering, I tell him what happened. Remembering is bad, but it feels even worse to say the words. My stomach starts to churn. I feel guilty, but I'm not sure why. It's confusing. Finally, I say, Do you think that someone hurt Aaron because of who Rod is and what he does? Do you think that it might not have been an accident? Dad looks scared. His left eye is sort of twitching. Someday, you and Aaron are going to leave this neighborhood and never come back. May that day come soon. He didn't answer my question directly, but I know he's talking in code, the way people do around here. So he's confirmed my suspicion. Go get your pop ready for his day, and I'll put on breakfast. And so I do. Chapter 31. Boy 21 emerges from his grandfather's Cadillac, looking very much like an earthling. He's wearing dark jeans, a polo rugby shirt with a huge oversized polo player on a horse symbol, and a cool leather jacket. No robe, cape, or helmet. Judging by the look on his face, I don't think I'm going to hear anything about outer space today.
Hey, Finley, he says. You okay?
I nod.
You hear anything more about Aaron?
I shake my head.
My grandparents are praying for her.
Thanks, I say, even though I'm not sure I believe in praying. Mostly because Dad, Pop, and I stopped going to church when I was a kid.
I'm sorry that Aaron's hurt so bad and won't be playing basketball.
Me too.
Do you want me to sit tonight's game out?
I look at Russ and say, why would I want you to do that?
I don't know.
I heard Coach K called about you.
I met Coach K a half dozen times, Russ says, as if Coach K were just any old person and not the head of perhaps the best collegiate basketball program in the country.
At camps. This means that Russ has been to summer invitation camps for the best high school players in the nation. They get to go for free and meet all sorts of basketball celebrities. Why are you here? I ask. I mean, you could be anywhere. Any prep school in the country would take you. What are you doing here?
I wanted to be near my grandparents, Russ says. Besides, maybe I need to be in Belmont.
This hellhole? Why?
To be your friend, he says. I don't understand why he would say that, so I just let it go.
I'm tired, and we've reached the high school.
As we go through the metal detectors, people start asking me questions about Aaron. I return to silent mode.
All day long, I think about Aaron and how strangers are operating on her leg, cutting it open, inserting pins or whatever to mend the bones. I worry that the surgeons won't get it right, and Aaron will have to walk with a limp, or even worse. I can't pay attention in any of my classes. And when I receive a slip that says to report to guidance during my lunch period, I don't even mind the fact that I'll have to speak to Mr. Gore, because it means I won't be around Russ. He keeps asking me if I'm okay, and it's getting really annoying. When I sit down across from Mr. Gore, I notice the Duke bumper sticker above his filing cabinet and start to get mad, although I'm not really sure why. You okay? Mr. Gore says. I shake my head. You want to talk about anything? His jerry curl is looking a little flat on the left side, like maybe he slept on it and didn't have time to do his hair this morning. I'm tired of Belmont, I say.
What do you mean?
I'm tired of seeing graffiti every day. I'm tired of drug dealers. I'm tired of people pretending that they don't see what's going on in the neighborhood. I'm tired of good people getting hurt. I'm tired of basketball. I'm tired of doing nice things for people and being punished for it. I just want to get out of here. I just want to escape.
The word simply popped out, which surprises me. Mr. Gore seems surprised too, especially since I never talked to him about anything important. He's trying not to smile, but I can tell he thinks he's making progress with me. Maybe he is.
Are you tired of Aaron?
His eyes are all excited now.
No.
And yet you broke up with her for basketball.
What does that have to do with her being in the hospital?
Absolutely nothing.
Why did you call me down here?
Because I care about you.
Mr. Gore is leaning forward. His forehead is damp like he's nervous. Or maybe like he really does care. When I look into his eyes, I see something that makes me feel as though maybe I was wrong about him all along. It's hard to explain. It's been a strange 24 hours, and I didn't sleep much last night.
You know, I played high school basketball, he says.
Really?
I find it hard to believe, because Mr. Gore is very thin and fragile looking. But he is tall.
Played in college, too, until I hurt my knee. I used to be able to dunk.
I try to picture Mr. Gore dunking, and the little movie I create in my mind makes me laugh.
As a young man, I dedicated my entire life to basketball. And you know what basketball does for me now?
He says.
What?
Nothing.
I think about what I'll be doing when I'm Mr. Gore's age, and I can't see myself playing ball. Even if I went pro, I'd be done playing. For some stupid reason, I see myself with Aaron. Maybe we're married.
We're all old and silly-looking, somewhere far from Belmont. Somewhere decent. But we're still together. I wonder if we really will be.
You don't owe anything to Coach, Mr. Gore says.
I just look at him for a second. He seems different to me, like he's on my side. Maybe I've had him all wrong. And his saying that about Coach makes me feel better for some reason.
You look tired, Finley.
I didn't sleep much last night. You want to catch a few Z's in my office?
Are you serious?
I'm in meetings this afternoon. If you want to take a nap, you can do so here. I'll let your teachers know that you're with me. Just don't go telling anyone my office is a hotel.
Mr. Gore shoots me a corny wink and then adds, "We good?"
I don't know if I'll be able to sleep in his office, but I would like some time alone. So I say, "Thanks."
"No problem. I'll be in the conference room next door if you need me."
He pats my shoulder twice before he exits, and then I'm alone. I stare out the window for 2 hours and think about Aaron. Halfway through the last period, I slip out of the building before Russ or anyone else can find me. Chapter 32. I walk around the crappy Belmont streets for a few hours before I return to the high school to watch our JV team play. When I pass him in the stands, Terrell says, "How's your little baby doing?" I stop and look into Terrell's eyes.
"Don't call her my little baby. You know she doesn't like that. She's told you hundreds of times. Show some respect,"
I say, hearing the anger in my voice. It surprises me.
"Okay, Finley," Terrell says. "Damn."
Hakeem and Sir exchange a glance, and then continue to watch the JV team play. Terrell was just trying to be nice, and I feel a little guilty for yelling at him. But I'm also glad that he called me Finley and not White Rabbit, which seems important. So I add, "Don't ever call Aaron my little baby again, okay?"
"Relax, Finley," Terrell says. "Watch yourself."
I know Terrell means I'm stepping out of line, that I've ignored the power structure here in Belmont, that I should know my place or else I'll be reminded. But I don't really care about all that right now. First, my starting position was taken for me, and now Aaron. What else matters? I sit down. Russ slides toward me and says,
"Where'd you disappear to during lunch?"
"I was with Mr. Gore," I say, and then stare at the JV game. Our team is already losing by 15. Coach Watts calls timeout and is now screaming at his starters about running an offense.
"Any offense!" he yells.
"You all right?" Wes says.
"Yeah," I say. "I just want to watch the game, okay?" Wes and Russ glance at each other, and then they leave me alone. So does the rest of the varsity team. When the JV squad finishes, we shoot around. I hit every shot I take. And then in the locker room, Coach announces the starting lineup, leaving out my name. No one says anything to me about my demotion, and I really don't care all that much. During warm-up drills, I see Pop and Dad in the stands, and I think about how Dad has his car with him. I could walk right over to him and say, "Let's go to the hospital to check up on Aaron." He'd say I should play the game, that I made a commitment to the team, but he'd take me if I pressed him. Russ gets the biggest roar by far when they announce the starters. Terrell looks at his sneakers. Coach's talk about the team will sound a little different to Terrell now that he's no longer the number one option. I'm standing behind Coach as he goes over the game plan. How to beat Brixton, tonight's opponent. But I'm not really listening at all. Then, I'm on the bench watching Wes win the jump ball, which he tips to Russ, who dribbles toward the basket. He dishes the ball to Hakeem, who scores an easy layup.
"Red, 22!" Coach yells,
and the team drops into a 2-2-1 press. I think about Mr. Gore saying basketball means nothing to him now. I suddenly realize I don't care whether we win this game or if I even play. It's a game. Aaron's in the hospital. What am I doing here? I never dreamed I'd stop caring about basketball, but I really couldn't care less about it right now. I stand and say, "I'm sorry, Coach. I have to go."
"What?"
Coach says.
"Where?"
I stride past the opposing team right up to Pop and Dad. "I should be at the hospital," I say. "I want to be there when Aaron wakes up." Coach Watts has followed me.
"Finley, you best get your butt back on our bench."
Pop looks at Coach Watts and says,
"He's got a lady in need."
"You know that there will be consequences," Dad says.
Last chance, Finley, Coach Watts says. All the people in the stands are staring at me like I'm a complete freak. The opposing coach calls a timeout to set up a press break, and as my teammates jog off the court, they stare at me too. I see concern on Russ's face. I should be at the hospital, Dad.
Okay, Dad says.
I push Pop's wheelchair out of the gym, and the night is more than refrigerator cold. It's freezer cold now. We get into the car, and Dad drives.
I'm proud of you, Pop says. People are more important than games.
I'm sorry, Dad says, because we all know my leaving means Coach has every right to never play me again. If I had simply asked to miss the game before it started, Coach would have probably let me go spend time with Aaron. No problem. But leaving the bench in the first quarter is unheard of. Dad and Coach both know that it means I basically just quit the team.
It's okay, I say, and then exit the car. Take this,
Dad says, handing me a $20 bill.
Call me when you're ready to come home. But if it's after I go to work, take a cab.
We don't have a lot of money, so 20 bucks is a big deal. It's Dad's way of saying he's okay with my decision. That he supports me. I tell the hospital people I'm Aaron's brother and I'm allowed in, even though it's not regular visiting hours.
Your parents are in the cafeteria, a woman says, and then points me in the right direction.
I find Mr. and Mrs. Quinn staring at coffee cups. They look up at me with tired eyes.
Don't you have a game tonight?
Mr. Quinn says.
Can I see Aaron?
They nod.
Just try not to wake her if she's still sleeping,
Mrs. Quinn says.
She needs her rest.
Mrs. Quinn gives me the room number, and when I find Aaron, her eyes are closed. Very quietly, I stand next to her bed and watch her breathe. The swelling in her face has gone down considerably. The IV drip in her arm means she's heavily drugged. Her bad leg is locked in a slightly bent position, and through the sheet fabric, I can see things poking through, which I imagine to be part of the metal skeleton that will hold her leg together as it mends. I don't want to see the damage just yet, so I don't peek. I think about running with Aaron, sprinting, climbing out onto my roof, her using her knee in all sorts of ways. Almost anything could be ruined. Everything is fragile. Temporary. Because I can't help it, I lean down and kiss her forehead once. And I think I see her smile for a second in her sleep. But it's dark, so I can't be sure.
You shouldn't be in here,
a nurse whispers from the doorway.
She needs her sleep.
I nod. I kiss Aaron's forehead once more. There's a notepad and pen on the table next to the bed, so I scribble a quick message. I was here. Love, Finley. I follow the nurse, who says,
She's your classmate?
My girlfriend. She nods once before she says,
You're a lucky man.
I am. I want to go sit with the Quinns, but for some reason I go to the waiting room instead and watch all the people who have kids staying overnight at the hospital or who are waiting for loved ones to wake up from surgeries or whatever. They all look just as concerned as I probably do. I see a mom and a dad holding hands, comforting each other. An elderly woman talks to a priest for a while, and a little kid sleeps with a teddy bear in one arm and his thumb in his mouth. So many people with problems and hurting sick family members. Just before they make us all leave, I look in on Aaron once more. She's sleeping comfortably, so I take a cab home. Chapter 33. The next morning over eggs and bacon, I ask Dad if I should skip school to check on Aaron. Before he can answer, Pop says, Yes.
Have you missed a day of high school yet? Dad asks.
Nope. Perfect attendance.
So what's one day?
Dad looks at me and says, You sure you don't want to talk to Coach? I think the team will be just fine without me.
Okay, Dad says. I don't like you quitting anything, but under the circumstances, I just wanted to make sure you're okay with the consequences, that you won't regret the decision later. I mean, you love basketball, Finley. Aaron's more important, right?
Pop pulls $2 from his shirt pocket, holds the money out to me, and says, Buy Aaron some flowers, will ya?
Tell her I'm looking forward to the next game of war.
Thanks, I will, I say. Even though flowers will cost more money, it's a nice gesture, and I appreciate it. He's probably been holding on to those $2 for years. My dad pays for everything around here, and Pop hasn't worked a day since he lost his legs. On his way to school, Russ shows up at my front door,
once again looking very terrestrial. It's like Boy 21 really has left the planet. I'm going to the hospital today, I say. Not going to school.